is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, July 12th, 2019. I'm Buster Olney, back in Bristol, Troy Farkas. And Troy, another baggage claim day. I'm sitting outside E14 at Dallas-Fort Worth Airport waiting for my flight home. It feels like every day this week we've been a different airport.
We have been, but you are enjoying the best one in the country as we speak.
It's a pretty, you know what? This airport's pretty good. I am glad they're bought. Baseball park, though, not so good. Being at that game last night, the first pitch was, what, 95, 96 degrees? I got to tell you, I'm not brokenhearted that they're closing down the old ballpark and going to the new one. And that one looks good. And I, you know, we were going over on our broadcast last night. We did the Astros and the Rangers. And of all the ones that really jumped out to me, the one was the fact that they were going to widen the seats from 18 to 20 inches.
Wow.
Which if you're selling the boomstick right at the ballpark, maybe that's a good way to go.
Oh, to widen
the seats.
For sure. Can't wait to get to that park.
It looks like it's going to be spectacular. All right, some news and notes of the day. The Astros' Jake Marisnick, before our game, we got word that he was suspended for two games for that collision with Angels catcher Jonathan Lucroy. He's appealing it. It wouldn't surprise me if, upon appeal, he winds up having that reduced from two to one game. Shelby Miller, who was recently released by the Rangers, agreed to a deal with the Milwaukee Brewers that was first reported by The Athletic. Rangers and the Astros, the first game of the second half down here in Arlington, and right away, bottom of the first inning, the Rangers were all over the Astros.
1-2 pitch, and Gallo swings, and a hard ground ball that kicks off the leg of Altuve, and a foul ground behind first. Coming in is to Shields. Around to third goes Mazzara, and Gallo ends up at second base. 2-0 Texas, as Altuve trying to go to his left in a sliding attempt on that hard ground ball at the bat of Gallo, and it kicked off the leg of Altuve in the foul ground behind first, and the Rangers catch a break.
Roxy Bernstein, ESPN Radio. That rally would continue with Rougned Odor.
Rougned Odor, left-handed batting second baseman, lines one to the right field corner. Skips off the warning track and up against the wall. That will score two as Gallo is in. Danny Santana comes home. Two-run double for Rougned Odor is at second base, and a four spot for the Rangers in the bottom of the first.
Frambier Valdez would not get out of the first inning for the Houston Astros, and his performance really underscored the need for the Astros to add some starting pitching help before the trade deadline. We're going to be talking about that with Dave Schoenfield coming up here in a little bit. Bottom of the third inning, Jeff Mathis, in his 15th season in the big leagues, got a hit.
Here comes the 2-2. Mathis hits it on a line to left coming in. Brantley plays it on a hop. Trotting home is Odor, stopping at second, Cabrera. Jeff Mathis, an RBI single. 5-0 Rangers.
And after a long second inning, Lance Lynn got on an absolute roll.
1-2 pitch, swing and a miss, struck him out, took something off. 10 strikeouts for Lance Lynn tonight.
And at top of the strike zone again, getting Alvarez out. That's something a lot of scouts are going to be watching on how they pitch to him going forward.
Jim Bowden chiming in there on ESPN Radio, and the Rangers win this game 5-0. Look, at the beginning of play yesterday, according to Fangraphs, number one pitcher in baseball in wins above replacement, Max Scherzer. Number two, Lance Lynn. And those numbers, of course, big leap. Chris Woodward, the Rangers' first-year manager, talked about the Rangers, and he talked about Lance Lynn.
Game, obviously, but it is important. Kind of sets the tone for the rest of them, hopefully. It is just one game, though. I mean, obviously, we preach stuff that's going to hopefully continue, you know, give us long-term success. We have a tough schedule. I mean, there's no way around it. And July is not going to be easy. But if we come out and start off the way we did, have a game plan against the guy and execute, and then we have our guy go out there and do what he did, you know, we're going to give ourselves a lot of chances to win games. And, you know, it is important. I was hoping we would kind of set the tone for the rest of the second half with a good win. And that was as good as it gets. Obviously, we scored early and we shut him out.
One other note, David Ortiz, who of course was shot recently down in Dominican Republic, is recovering after his third surgery for a gunshot wound. His wife Tiffany announced the latest injury in a statement released Thursday by the Red Sox. She did not disclose details about the complications that led to the surgery, but said Ortiz is recovering well and in good spirits. Now, before we talk to Dave Schoenfield, I want to tell you about Valspar. Are you staining your deck this summer again? Well, this time, maybe you should try something that's stain-changing. Introducing Valspar Solid Color Stain. It's easy to apply, all-weather protection that brings so much color and coverage to the party. You can bring out the color of the shutters or the planters or even your eyes. You'll love it, guaranteed, for 10 years. Valspar Exterior Stain, get it only at Lowe's. Yeah, that's stain-changing.
Welcome to the show!
Welcome to the show.
Welcome to the show.
Welcome to the show.
Welcome to the show!
Welcome to the show, mate!
Welcome to the show! Whoa!
Welcome to the show, baby!
You're in the show with David Schoenfield.
And the show this week is happening very early in the morning. We're taping this early on Friday. I'm at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. Dave Schoenfield decided to get up with me. We're taping it about, what time is it? 7 o'clock your time, Dave. Thank you.
7 o'clock. It is my off day, Buster. But, you know, we got to take the dogs out. We got to do some yard work today. So this will just get my day going a little earlier. That's okay. All good.
And so when you got that great wag from the dogs in the morning when they first see you, I can take a little bit of credit for that, right?
You can. They were so tired. We have, like, what we call our dog room with the couches that belong only to the dogs. They didn't move, so I didn't even take them outside anyway. So we'll do it.
You're
after
kidding.
The podcast.
You mean, like, that's really funny. So even when you came downstairs, your dog's like, no, sorry, we're sleeping. Come back later.
The one dog, she wagged her tail as she remained on the couch, and she just rolled over, scratched my tummy, you know. So, all good. I think she's still happy to see me. Maybe not. I don't know.
Man, I got some insight into to you. I mean, you have a whole dog throne there going on there. That's pretty cool.
Well, we don't have that room we never use, right? You know, the dining room or the room attached to the dining room. So we call it the dog room.
Very nice. All right. So the first game of the second half was played last night. The Rangers against the Astros. And before the game, of course, we meet with the managers, and Chris Woodward, the first-year manager of the Rangers, told us about his conversation with his players before the game last night. And I love this, and let me see if you liked it as much as I did. So what he told the players was, look, by the end of the month, we're going to look different than we are right now, and it depends on what happens in the next couple weeks. We don't know whether or not we're going to be adding players. We don't know whether some of the guys in the room are going to be traded to other teams. And his feeling was, look, there's pressure in what we do. It's inherent, and there's no point in running from that, and there's no point in not highlighting the fact that they're really at a crossroad in their season. And I loved the direct nature of that, to put it all out on the table for the players, say, hey, you have control over what's ahead of you. Do you like that as much as I did?
No, I do, you know, and why not be honest with your players? I don't see what the harm is in doing that. And these guys, they all understand the business of today's game. And I think they probably understand where the Rangers are. Everything has gone right for the Rangers. For the Astros, a lot has gone wrong. And the Rangers are still 8 games behind Houston. I get that they're in the wild card race. They certainly have a shot there. So yeah, the Rangers probably have the hardest decisions to make, maybe, of any of these contenders on what they'll do at the deadline this year. But I love that. Be honest with your players. Tell them what the franchise is thinking.
And we'll get to that. We're going to run through a bunch of teams and we'll play a game of buy, sell, or hold. But first, I just also want to mention that before the game, we found out that Jake Mareznick got a 2-game suspension for his collision with Jonathan Lucroy the other day. Lucroy, of course, had to be hospitalized, had a concussion, had a broken nose. Not surprised that he was suspended, because I think once the review went against him on Sunday, it almost locked baseball into Major League Baseball into a course of action in which they were going to do something, especially after Lucroy got hurt. And I also think it's basically a fait accompli that his suspension will be reduced from 2-game to 1-game, because I haven't talked to anybody who thinks that he tried to hurt him on purpose. And I talked to Jake before yesterday's game, and he was talking about his conversation with Jonathan Lucroy, after the collision. He called him after the game to check on him. And you could tell even yesterday, emotionally, he was really bothered by the perception that he was trying to injure him. A.J. Hinch, the Astros manager, pointed out to us that as the collision happened, you look at his arms, it wasn't like he drew up his arms together like he was an offensive lineman trying to, you know, hit him in the face. His arms were at his side. He was still in the process of trying to change direction because he thought Luke Roy was going to go to the foul side of the line, and instead he wound up going to the fair side of the line, and that's where the collision happened.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm with you. I think he obviously feels pretty bad about what happened. Unfortunately, by the letter of the law, he did veer out of his natural base running, you know, path. So he's going to get the suspended. We'll see if they reduce it. And, you know, this is just a reminder of why we have the rule, whether it's intentional or not. You can't do what he did. So if it's two games or one game, he's going to miss at least a game for the Astros.
All right. Let's play a game of buy, sell, or hold.
Okay.
I've been told by general managers that the first 7 to 10 days after the All-Star break are going to be critical for a lot of contenders. That's what a lot of these teams are communicating to other clubs about their trade intentions. And we'll start with the Rangers. As of this morning, 49-42 record, 2.5 games out in the American League wild card race. If you're sitting in John Daniels' shoes, buy, sell, or hold.
Man, like I said, this is the John Daniels has a really difficult decision. I don't know if I do anything, to be honest. I don't sell. I'm not selling Mike Minor. I know he only has one more year. I'm not selling Lance Lynn, who has two more years. These guys have been really good. Isn't that the goal, to get really good baseball players? I like the improvements these guys have made. I don't think they're necessarily fluke seasons. You know, I know they're veteran guys, so you might be skeptical of what they're doing. But next year, you move into the new park. You want a good team next year in the new park. You got to keep your two best starting pitchers. So I don't think they're selling Mike Minor or Lance Lynn. How much they add, I don't think they're going to go big on the buy side. Like we said, they're still way behind the Astros, the wild card race, no guarantee. You know, maybe they add like every other team, add a reliever or two. So I guess if it's buy or sell, I'll say buy.
And I would hold for at least another 10 days because they played the game against the Astros last night. They have three more games in this series. And after they play two games against Arizona, then they play three more against the Astros. And at that point, I think that your situation might be more clear if you're JD. And I'm with you. My reflex would not be, well, we're not good enough. Like a lot of these teams, I think, and that their feeling is if we can't win the World Series, then we'll just sell. I think because they're moving into a new ballpark next year, that shapes a lot of their decisions. And you have to worry about having a really good team in 2020. I agree. You hang on to Mike Minor. You hang on to Lance Lynn for sure, regardless of what other stuff you do. Hunter Pence, you know, maybe he's someone who you're going to move before the deadline if they take a downward turn. Troy, you're a Rangers fan. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I really wouldn't change anything. I love the way that Lynn and Minor are pitching, and Hunter Pence, I mean, I definitely want to keep him. He's a high-energy guy, and he's been great for them. I want to keep him as long as we can.
All right, buy, sell, or hold for the Boston Red Sox, 49-41, Dave. They're 9 games out of first place in the American League East, but, of course, they're right in the thick of the wild card race. They currently stand fourth, 2 games behind the Cleveland Indians. If you're Dave Dombrowski, buy, sell, or hold?
I'm buying. You're the Boston Red Sox. I know the odds of winning the division are slim, but you're still trying to make the playoffs. I know I keep waiting for this team to go on a roll where they win 13 out of 15 or something like that. I think they still have the talent to do that. I'm buying. Obviously, when you're buying with the Red Sox, you got to add a closer. The bullpen just has not been clutch all year. So I go after Will Smith, maybe increase that bullpen depth. So I'm buying if I'm Dave.
And I feel like, and you've made reference to the fact that a lot of teams are going to be adding relief help. I think there's going to be a lot of salary dumps in the last, say, 4 to 7 days before the deadline, where, you know, teams that are out of contention will say, yeah, why don't you take this veteran reliever who's making, whatever, $3 million and, you know, take the last $1 million and you don't really have to give us anything. I think there are going to be opportunities for the Red Sox, even if they don't want to go in heavy. The Arizona Diamondbacks, 46-45, a game and a half out in the wild card race in the National League. Forget the division. The Dodgers are going to win the division. They got a huge lead out there. If you're the Diamondbacks, are you buying, selling, or holding?
I'm just holding. You know, I'm not selling because I look at that run differential for Arizona, plus 53. So I think their team that's maybe even played a little better than that 46-45 record. But again, you know, when you're chasing a wild card, I never want to go too far in. You know, what are you mortgaging the future for a coin flip game? So you're not going to catch the Dodgers. You're not a great team. So I'm holding if I'm Arizona.
I'm selling because okay. I don't think in Arizona, I mean, they've made the playoffs, right, in yep. recent years. I don't think making it as a wild card team and feeling like that you probably have no chance to get much deeper than that. I'm absolutely out there. If I can move Zach Greinke, and I don't think they can because he's making so much money, and a trade of Greinke would be very complicated, or if someone gives you something really good for Robbie Ray, I'm absolutely selling.
Yeah, I guess Greinke, I mean, like you said, the odds of trading him with that contract appear slim. I guess you never know if they eat some of the money. You know, with the year he's having, 10-3, 2.73 ERA, that strikeout to walk ratio is off the charts. Who wouldn't want Zach Greinke just based on the numbers, of course? I don't know. I mean, what are the odds of trading him? 15% maybe?
At most. I mean, yeah. Especially with that salary. Unless the Diamondbacks are willing to eat, I bet you anywhere from $10 to $15 million annually in that contract. And that not a lot of teams this time of year are going to be willing to line up and do that. San Diego Padres, 45-45. They're right next to where the Diamondbacks are. If you're sitting in AJ Preller's shoes, buy, sell, or hold.
Okay, I'm going to buy if I'm the Padres, but only if it's for a controllable pitcher, a guy like Matthew Boyd or Noah Syndergaard, maybe even a Marcus Stroman. I'm not going for just an immediate one-year fix for a guy who's a free agent, but I think I love where they're going. We obviously love the youth, but adding a veteran, proven starting pitcher, not just for a chase at the wild card, but a guy who will help you next year. I'm willing to do that.
I am buying and I'm selling. I'm okay. Absolutely trading Kirby Yates if I'm the Padres because I don't think his value is going to be get any higher than it is right now. I totally agree with you, too, that part of the target and the move of using their surplus of outfielders should be to acquire that surplus starter. But I'm trading Kirby Yates this summer. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I can't disagree with you. He's arguably been the best closer in baseball this year, and the Padres, as bad as they've been over the last decade, they've had no problem building bullpens and coming up with guys like Kirby Yates. So, yeah, look, if the Red Sox are buying, you know, if the Nationals are buying a reliever, you can get a nice return for Kirby Yates. So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Maybe the most interesting team to me among all 30 teams in terms of their trade decisions coming up, the Cleveland Indians.
Yeah.
50-38. 5.5 games behind the Minnesota Twins, you know, in good position in the wild card race, and they open up the second half playing the Twins this weekend. If you're Chris Antonetti, buy, sell, or hold.
Yeah, you're right. This might even be a tougher decision than the one John Daniels is facing because how is this the last run with this group of players that have made 3 playoffs in a row? You know, because even looking in the offseason, what are you going to be doing with Francisco Lindor? I get, you know, plus there's the unknown of Corey Kluber and Carlos Carrasco. I guess if you know you're going to get Kluber back and you're going to hopefully get Carrasco back, maybe you sell Trevor Bauer if you can get some offense. I don't know. I guess I'm confused on this one. I don't know what I would do. I guess I'd lean slightly towards selling Trevor Bauer if you know you're going to get a big bat in return.
And I'm going to be completely gullus and say I would buy, sell, and hold. See, I'm certainly going to wait until you get done the series against the Twins. That'll give you some clarity. Could you possibly be 2.5 games out, which would change the equation if they were to sweep the Twins? And if they were to get swept, that would also add some clarity to their situation. I'm absolutely trading Trevor Bauer under any circumstance, no matter if they sweep the Twins or not. Because my feeling would be, look, Trevor Bauer, if you're a small market team, you have to take advantage of an elite player's or a high-end player's trade value when you know that they're going to leave. And he's not going to be part of this team beyond 2020. He's a free agent. You need to get return. The one caveat at this point, because they are playing better, and if they continue to play well, that fan base would go nuts if they got, you know, a couple of Class A guys we're not going to see for 4 years. I do think whatever combination of trades you make, if you're the Indians, to your point, you have to get guys who are in the big leagues, young, controllable, outfielders who are going to add to the offense. The San Diego Padres have a lot of that. I think the Houston Astros also have a lot of that. And but Trevor Bauer is a type of pitcher that the Astros really value. So I'm being completely gutless, and I'm saying buy, sell, and hold for the Cleveland Indians. You want to chime in?
Yeah, it's tough too, you know, when we were just in Cleveland for the All-Star game, and I know the Indians don't draw well, but, you know, you walk around downtown Cleveland, everybody was wearing their Indians t-shirts and jerseys. So I know there is a lot of baseball enthusiasm in that city, but if you trade Bauer and then knowing long-term you're not going to be able to sign Lindor and you probably trade him, man, what does that do to baseball in that city, though? So you run that risk of just, you know, killing that enthusiasm if you tear this team apart. But if the trades work and you remain a playoff contender, then that enthusiasm remains, even if you don't have Lindor in 2022. So, yeah, the Indians are in a really, really tough position, but Trevor Bauer could be that difference maker for the Houston Astros. And if you can get a Kyle Tucker or a Forrest Whitley, you know, you do that trade, I guess.
Yep, exactly. All right, let's go buy, sell, or hold for all the National League Central. That, of course, the most fascinating division because only 4.5 games separate the five teams. I'll just run through it quickly. For me, if I'm the Cubs, I'm buying around the edges and I'm listening if anybody has major ideas, especially about Kyle Schwarber. If I'm the Brewers, I'm absolutely buying a starting pitcher at some point to improve that rotation. If I'm the Cardinals, a little bit like the Cubs, if I have opportunities I see to get better, maybe a Madison Bumgarner, I would at least consider that. Pirates, I'm more of in a holding pattern. I'm listening to offers on Felipe Vasquez. And if I'm the Reds, I'm absolutely buying. Because of all these five teams, to me, the needle is moved the most for the Cincinnati Reds if they actually find a way to get to the postseason. And there's a lot of really cool and great parts of about the Reds team. So if they can add some kind of a hitter who helps that inconsistent offense, do it.
Yeah, this is going to sound boring, but I'm going to agree on all five teams. I put my strongest buy, without a doubt, the Brewers starting pitcher. You know, Bumgarner, I know it's not 2014 anymore, but man, I'm going to gamble on this guy and hope we can get to the postseason and have this guy in my rotation. And Cincinnati, yeah, with all the guys on, you know, kind of the 1 year deals, they're only 4.5 back. They have a plus 27 run differential. The bullpen, if they can get those late innings straightened out, they're not out of it. So I'm with you. A strong buy on the Reds as well.
Right. Real quick before you go, a lot of focus this week on the new rules that are being put in place by the Atlantic League. The other night in their All-Star game, they used the robotic umpire, and I think you and I would agree that eventually that's going to happen in Major League Baseball. But in the second half of the Atlantic League, some of the rules being used, one foul bunt is allowed with two strikes before it becomes a strikeout. Batters may try to steal first base on any pitch when it's not caught in flight. And, you know, people, that's why the references you'll see in stories about batters having the opportunity to steal first base. But the rule change, which I think has a real chance to be implemented in Major League Baseball at some point, that I think is really being overlooked, that could be a difference maker, is this rule that all pitchers have to break contact with the rubber before throwing a pickoff to first base. And for years, I mean, since the beginning of time, the rules for pickoff moves have been different for left-handers than right-handers. And the left-handers could stare down a runner, and if they had a halfway decent move, nobody could run against them. And with this rule now, left-handers have to break contact with the rubber before throwing to first base. It's going to make it so much better for base runners who are thinking about stealing. I love that potential change. What do you think?
Yeah, I do too. And I we were talking before we went on the air. This has a chance to really be maybe the most, other than the robot umpires, the most important of all these rule changes. That anything that can potentially open up the running game, I think it's a big positive, add excitement to the game. You know, we always talk about the 1980s were so great. Guys were stealing 80, 100 bases. Well, one reason they don't run as much anymore, not just the sabermetrics, but pitchers have gotten so good at holding runners. You know, they learn they had to, you know, so if it becomes a little harder to hold the base runners, that opens up the speed game. I'm all for it. I'm curious to see how this one plays out.
Yeah, and the rationale, the thinking behind it is, look, this is a way for Major League Baseball to experiment with ideas that are going to increase the running game and to increase action, to increase things that, that happen. And that rule, if Major League Baseball implements at some point, there's no doubt it would completely change the dynamic for a base runner at first base trying to steal against a left-hander. So I'm excited to see what kind of results they get with that one. Dave, thanks for getting up early, and I hope your dogs are ready to take you out for a walk now.
We'll go around the block as soon as I hang up with you.
So we were talking about Chris Woodward, the Rangers manager, and his conversation with his players before they began the second half on Thursday evening. Well, Roxy Bernstein, ESPN Radio, spoke with Chris before Thursday's game. Give a listen.
Your team has been a great story. In the first half, people didn't know what to expect from the Texas Rangers coming into the season your first year. What did you expect heading into spring training from this ball club?
It's tough to say. Until you start to see those guys compete on a daily basis, how much buy-in you were going to get, I guess where we were as far as who's playing well, who's not. It's hard. I didn't even know what to expect, to be honest with you. I knew we had a great group of guys. After talking to them all spring and all offseason, I knew they cared about each other, which was big for me, obviously establishing a culture. I tried to lay my expectations out from day one and what I expected of them from a competitive standpoint, how they go about their business, how prepared they are. But to see it kind of all take shape early on, we won a lot of series early on against some pretty good teams. I think that carried over to some a little bit of a snowball effect and believing that we can beat anybody. And we dealt with our, you know, ups and downs. We got swept by Houston in Houston. That was probably the low point, even though we were playing decent at the time. But I think the resiliency of this ball club is shown through in-game, multiple game stretches where we just don't quit, man. Like our guys, you know, ninth inning, we're down by eight. We're still having 10 pitch at bats. I think the definition of who we are is pretty clear. And, you know, I'm proud of our guys for that, but we got a long way to go. And to become a champion, like, we're going to have to obviously get better in a lot of ways, but our guys are invested in that and they want to do that.
As a skipper, can you get a sense of the buy-in factor from the guys in the clubhouse? From the outside, we think it's there, but what do you see as a manager of this team?
Yeah, I do. I'm proud. Like I said, I'm proud of our guys. They have bought in quite a bit. From a collective group, I think it's pretty special what's going on. They have a pretty deep belief that we're going to be a playoff team. And there's a lot of guys in there that you won't convince otherwise. And I think that, you know, we can insulate that inside our walls and not allow those other ideas to come in. That's what's going to separate us. That's what's going to make us continue this. But at the same time, like, I'm not afraid to address where we lack, I guess. And I talk to our guys about it all the time and just trying to push us forward every day.
You're an amazing story. You made it to the major leagues, the 54th round draft pick. You made it as a player, now as a manager. Obviously, Dave Roberts had an influence working with him the last few years. But who else has really shaped you and helped you become the manager that you are right now?
I think that's honestly like a collective group of guys. Obviously, Dave, you know, I got to witness his, first year manager in 16 and then the last, obviously, 3 years and the success we had in LA, you know, he's obviously a big factor. Wakamatsu, my bench coach, I played for him in Seattle, and that was kind of at the end of my career, but just the way he treated me, the way he treated everybody around him, Bobby Cox, Jim Fregosi was my first manager. I learned the tough, hard, you know, honest truth, you know, from Jim. But I really appreciated that as a player. A lot of people were scared of that. As a rookie, I really admired that because I knew where I stood. He told me I wasn't going to play, and I didn't play. He told me when I was going to play, and you know, and I did. So I've taken a lot of – I've had 10 first-year managers, I think, throughout my career, which is pretty staggering to think of. But, you know, taking something from pretty much all of it, and was very open-minded, and ears were wide open, eyes were wide open to see who I liked, why I liked them. Started to develop my own philosophies, obviously, at the end of my career. And, you know, like I said, taking a piece from everybody maybe.
Chris, appreciate the time. Best of luck in the second half.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
We'll be back in a moment with Kenny Lofton. But first, summer is here, and you know what that is? It's barbecue season. And if you're like me, you'll be serving your friends and family the incredible meat from ButcherBox. I got my ButcherBox package about a month ago, and man, my son absolutely loves the hamburgers we have. My favorite, the bacon. It's tremendous in how it tastes. From grass-fed beef to free-range organic chicken to wild-caught sockeye salmon from Bristol Bay, Alaska, ButcherBox has over 20 different cuts of meat to choose from, with customizable boxes and a variety of other options to choose from. They work closely with the best farms and companies committed to raising animals humanely. This ensures not only an ethical process, but one results in a better quality, better-tasting, nutrient-dense meat, with no added hormones or antibiotics ever. And a month's worth of the meat from ButcherBox comes out to less than $6 a meal. ButcherBox is delivered right to your door with free shipping. And guess what? To new members who sign up at ButcherBox.com/BBTN, they're offering $20 off the first box plus 6 free burgers, those burgers that my son loves, in every box until October 15th. That's ButcherBox.com/BBTN. For $20 off your first box, plus free burgers in every box until October 15th. ButcherBox.com/BBTN.
It's time to make the call. Call to the legend on Baseball Tonight.
Kenny Lofton played 17 years in the big leagues, racked up 1,528 runs, 622 stolen bases, 2,428 hits. He led his league in stolen bases 5 straight years, was an All-Star 6 times, a Gold Glover 4 times. Kenny, thanks for joining the show. How you doing?
I'm doing great. I can't complain. It's all good.
All right. So Kenny is here on behalf of Bank of America, the official bank of Major League Baseball, to help launch the Bank of America Extras program to reward customers with unique baseball experiences, exclusive access and discounts, so they have the power to get more of what they love all season long. Kenny, what are you doing with Bank of America?
Well, you know, a good thing about it, I'm excited about being, you know, part of this because it is, you know, in Cleveland for the All-Star Week. And I'm just glad to have Bank of America and myself. You know, now they are the official Major League Baseball sponsor for this All-Star Week. So I'm just excited about their having this program. It's called the Baseball America Extras. And it's basically an awards program for their customers to get, you know, different packages and one-of-a-kind experiences for this week because of the All-Star Week. And I'm saying, and also, again, this thing, it can go on throughout the whole of Bank America through the rest of the season, starting July 17th through the rest of the season.
Very nice. And you can visit bankofamerica.com/extras to learn more about that. Now, you mentioned about the All-Star Game being in Cleveland this year. What, when you go back there and you bump into fans, what type of things do they like to relive with you?
Well, again, just certain things I've done, and especially during the All-Star Week, you know, what was my most memorable All-Star Game or my first one or something like that. But it'll be a whole lot of things that people can bring up, but who knows? I just pretty much answered the questions.
Yeah, and I feel like, I got to tell you, when I think back on history, and I started covering baseball in 1989, that I feel like that the Indians teams that you played on are going to be some of the greatest teams that, you know, didn't win a championship, and they were totally dominant at that time. I always felt like the 94 Expos were one of those teams, 2001 Mariners, and you guys. The best team I thought was the 95 Indians. Out of that group of teams, when you guys were selling out every night at the Jake, which of those teams do you feel like was the best team?
I think the 95 team was, I can look at that, was always been the best teams. And we had a a lot of all-stars. We had a lot of guys who put up some great numbers throughout that whole year, and that was pretty much the exciting part about that whole process.
It felt like that you guys at that time, that's when your offense was absolutely at its best. The depth is incredible when you got guys like Manny Ramirez hitting down in the bottom half of the lineup. That's crazy to think about a group of hitters like that.
Well, the thing about it is when we had that lineup like that, we were never out of the game. And we used to take everything we had probably over 25 of late game comebacks, extra innings. And think of talking about extra innings. Also, the program part of the America Extra is talking about the extra innings to where starting again January 17th until the rest of the season, if a team goes into extra innings, Bank of America have these discounts where you can receive a 25% discount from the team shop gear of Major League Baseball from 9 a.m. to the next day, 9 a.m. So if a team like Boston or New York go into extra innings, that next morning at 9 a.m. for 24 hours, the Bank of America customers get discounts of 25% for the gear for that next 24 hours under Major League Baseballshop.com, Bank of America.
And that's
extras.
And you mentioned that that starts on July 17th, right?
Yes. So extra innings. So which we were talking about that Cleveland, we had so many extra inning comebacks during that time. So it just kind of plugged that on in into that.
Now, what was it like for you? I know as a writer, Albert Bell was at his most intimidating time during those teams. What was he like to play with?
Again, I always try to tell people he was a little different talking to people and maybe dealing with the media at times. But when you have the game on the line, you want Albert Bell on your team. And he was one of the guys where I felt sorry for Mike Hargrove sometimes because he used to come in there and sometimes he wanted to give Albert a day off. And when Albert walks into the clubhouse and if his name is not on the lineup card, he is pissed off. So he would have to go into the manager's office and say, hey, where's my name? I belong in the lineup. He wanted to play every single day. And that was just the cool part about it. And I felt sorry for Hargrove. I'm like, you better put his name back on the board because you know he's going to come in here screaming and fussing. But that's one thing about Albert. He wanted to play.
Now, and of course, in 95, despite the fact you guys played a shortened season of 144 games, he finished that year with 50 doubles and 15 homers, which is crazy. Were you in the room? One of the stories, of course, at the time was he got the nickname Mr. Freeze from smashing the air conditioner, indicator in your clubhouse. Were you there in the room when that took place?
Well, I wasn't in the room when that took place, but I was the reason why it took place.
Really?
Because, yeah, everybody was kind of afraid of Albert, but I wasn't. So some of the clubhouse kids came out into the dugout because Albert used to go into the clubhouse every day, after he'd have his at-bats, and he'll write down all his – he had notes galore in his locker. He used to write down what happened to the batter in front of him, what happened to the batter behind him, and he wrote all the notes down of the pitchers, the pitches, what they threw to them all the time, and he used to go back and write it down. So when he come back in the clubhouse, he used to turn the air conditioner up freezing. So when in the clubhouse kids say, Andy Kennedy, he did it again. So I used to go in there and turn the heat back up. And he goes, after another bat, he goes back and turn it all the way back down. So all of a sudden, he got mad because I end up turning it all the way up, the heater. He went in and turned it all the way down in order for me to not turn it back up. He had to smash the thermostat, and that was the only thermostat in the clubhouse, in the locker room. So
wow,
I came in, and it was a big hole in the wall.
Yeah, that was funny, because I always heard the story was that it was Omar Vizquel that did that turned it up. So it was you, huh?
No, it was me, because I was
All right, so you were on the Hall of Fame ballot one time, and you were one of the reasons why I stopped voting. I stopped about a few years ago because I felt like the process was so unfair to players who were going through it, because I felt like because of the rules, where you have a ballot limit of 10, that individual players were not being assessed on their career credentials. And I ran through your numbers, and you're certainly in the conversation for the Hall of Fame. You should be. but you were only on the ballot 1 year because of all the Hall of the steroid era candidates who were stacked up on the ballot. How disappointing was that for you not to move on after that first year?
I mean, I was very disappointed about it because I felt like you said, I was felt like I should have been the guy to where you could just keep looking at my numbers, comparing my numbers year after year to other guys to stack up where my numbers were. And when I had the opportunity, but then I found out kind of why my the reason why I got kind of shunned out in this situation. That made me even more furious, knowing that the guys who were potential or caught or whatever with the situation with the steroids is that they had to almost vote for, I think it was like 6 or 7 guys at that time. They had to keep trying to vote for them, keep them on the ballot so they can keep accessing the situation. And that leaded only maybe 3 or 4 spots open for guys that were already on the ballot that they were trying to keep on the ballot. And then people like myself were kind of like, okay, we need to keep these guys on to keep checking out their numbers and throughout the process. And when I found that the reason why a lot of voters, most of the voters, voted for the PET, PED guys. And that made me pissed off because I'm like, wait a minute, I stacked up just as well as they did, even though I didn't use PEDs. So I felt like my numbers were comparable, but it wasn't over the top where they stopped, where they could have a chance to keep looking at it. So that just makes me more furious, just furiated about when they talk about Hall of Fame and PED guys, I get highly upset about it.
Yeah, and so where does that anger, directed at? Are you more angry at the guys who chose to do it? Or are you more angry at the system, at the way that the sport played out during that time?
Well, I think the system, for sure, of how they put the voting ballot down there, but also I think the fact that you have this exclusive club, like a guy like Eddie Murray, you have Paul Molitor, you have Ozzie Smith, Barry Larkin, those guys who put up real good numbers, real numbers without cheating, they're in the Hall of Fame. But then you got guys who are trying to be in that same, that exclusive club, in which they cheated themselves to help themselves get in that club. But at the time, I felt like they didn't care about the Hall of Fame then when they were making all that money because they were getting, putting up those numbers so they could make the money. They didn't think about the Hall of Fame. But now, since they're done playing, now they want to use the next bump up to start talking about the Hall of Fame. And I just don't like the way people talk about those guys in the same category as the true baseball players who didn't cheat the game.
Kenny Lofton is here representing Bank of America. You can find out more information about the Extras program, bankofamerica.com/extras. Kenny, it's interesting because, as I say, I started covering in 1989. The first time I started to hear about it was when I was covering the Reds AAA team in the late 80s. And then, of course, in the mid 90s, it was an open secret where a lot of players assumed something was going on, but they didn't exactly know what it was and to what level. When did you start to have an awareness?
I started to have an awareness when they started talking about Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire. When the chicks, what they called, talking about the chick dig the long ball, that commercial, that thing that came about,
yep.
That's what really had me an idea of what's going on. Because I saw Sammy Sosa play. I saw Mark McGwire play. And I played against both of them. So seeing how they performed, and they started to get older, and they started to get better as they got older. And that was confused because, again, I played the game the right way. And when you saw that Sammy Sosa pretty much almost got the bat knocked out of his hand when he played, then all of a sudden he started hitting balls out the ballpark. And then, which go for Mark McGwire, you started to see him hit a lot of home runs. But he was hitting home runs that were, if he hit a good one, it'd go like 15 rows back. You know what I mean? But all of a sudden, this guy started hitting the ball out the stadiums. I'm like, okay, something ain't right. When you start seeing those guys hit the balls out of the stadium, in which hitting a home 15 rows up was a pretty good home run. And that's what made me think, like, something's not right. And then you look at the size of these guys. They go from my size to they go into Frank Thomas' size. And it just didn't add up. And something, if you don't know, you keep your mouth closed. So that's what pretty much all of us did until – Jose Canseco made his comment, and we was like, we already kind of had an idea what Jose was doing because he kind of didn't really hide it a whole lot. But, you know, we kind of had it, but we wouldn't know for sure. But once he came out and said something about it, we was like, oh, okay. Now we kind of know what it really was.
And it's interesting because I remember having a lot of conversations with a lot of players off the record in the 90s, and so many of them told me that they hated the choice they were forced to make. Like, if you wanted to keep up competitively, then you had to at least, you know, consider doing that. Or if you, you knew that if you didn't do it, then you would fall behind. And they were angered by that. And it's interesting because I bump into guys now who played in the 90s, and they're more angry now than they were then, feeling like, you know what, I had something taken away from me. How do you feel?
I mean, I feel the same way. I felt like, because, again, before they started to use the home runs thing, I had that 94, 95 season. And I put these incredible numbers up there. 94 season, I was fourth in ballot in the MVP ballot because of my numbers from 94. 95 hit, and then all of a sudden from 96 on, they started to look at my numbers as at the low of the totem pole because of the home runs where everybody started digging the long home runs. And all of a sudden, my numbers start to look, like I said, again, at the low of the totem pole. I mean, getting on base, stealing, because, again, I just felt like on-base percentage was a big thing, and I felt guys should get on base, but they didn't care about that anymore. I started going to teams, and they started to want to platoon me because they wanted to platoon me to put in a home run hitting guy. I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. Why is this starting that way? Because, again, that's when it really started. People started making money for hitting home runs, and that was it. Getting on base, having a high on-base percentage, average base hits meant nothing. You got paid at the lower scale, and the guys who were hitting a lot of home runs started to get at the upper echelon scale of getting paid. So that's why I guess these guys felt like, well, you know what? For me to get paid, I got to hit home runs. You know, you have a guy named Brady Anderson hit, you know, 15, 16 home runs, and all of a sudden he goes to 50. He's like, okay, something ain't right. But he got paid because he hit 50 home runs. He wouldn't have got paid by hitting those 15, 60 home runs that he did before free agency. He hits 50 and he gets paid the big bucks. So that's the way the game was going.
Again, we're talking with Kenny Lofton, who's representing Bank of America. Kenny, when you look back at that time then, with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, what do you think should have been done? Because I, you know, as a writer at Cover the Sport, I look back and say, you know what, I didn't do a good enough job in my job, illuminating what was happening in the sport. But I feel like that a lot of people contributed. It's, I always call it the pyramid of blame for where baseball got to with steroids. Who do you feel like, or what do you think should have been different?
I think Major League Baseball should have took a bigger look into it than what they did. They kind of did a half crap, you know, job of looking into it the way they were supposed to look into it. And then with the Players Association, they try to kind of, you know, just kind of play the field. You know, they were playing the field and see how they can still manage the situation without trying to, you know, destroy the whole situation. But I just felt like Major League Baseball had a chance to step their game up and say, hey, we're going to go straight, you know, testing. But they wanted to stay away from the straight testing at the time. And then they end up doing that, what they call, I call it a courtesy test, when they tried to test and told guys that if you, even though it's not going to be shown who's going to be, who got tested or whatever or not, that they had their two separate numbers of the guys' names, and their numbers would never match up. So they wouldn't know who did it, but they would know the percentages sort of if they want to keep the testing process going. And then once the Mitchell report came out, it found out the Balco and all that situation, somehow those names and numbers came together, and that's how they found out that guys were using, you know, preferably like the guy like A-Rod, they knew he was using because the names came together because of that because of the Balco situation.
Yeah, and then, of course, that was survey testing done in 2003. As you know, there were members of the Chicago White Sox and I believe one other team who actually – young players wanted to skip the test entirely because they wanted testing. They wanted a non-test to be counted as a positive so that testing would be put in place. I felt like, as I say, I think a lot of people were responsible for where the sport got to. I felt like the union didn't do a good job of representing the clean interests of players at that, excuse me, the interests of clean players at that time as much as when they talked about privacy interests. Looking back on it, agree, disagree with me?
No, I agree. It's just, it's again, it's all about money. And that's the play. You know, when they say money is the root of all evil, that was part of the evil of money that I saw in the game of baseball. Players Association and the owners had that part because it was bringing money into the game. After they had the strike going on, they didn't feel like people were going to be coming back to the game like they're supposed to. So they just kind of brushed it off the shoulder to see what happened. And then the game started to come back. And then they should have, once they felt the game came back, that's when they should have just hit it hard. But no one did.
Imagine if in, let's say, 5 years, 10 years, you get a call, a veterans committee has elected you to the Hall of Fame. What would that mean to you? And how would you use that platform to Cooperstown?
Again, for me, I just want to, you know, again, the opportunity to get to the elite players who did the game the right way. And I just wanted to, that would be a good opportunity to show, hey, just playing the game the right way, even though my numbers didn't stack up to the PED guys, but I did play the game the right way, way it's supposed to get. And I thought the game had different parts to it. You had, you know, leadoff, you had every position. And I felt like at that time I played the game the right way. I did what I was supposed to do. My job was to get on and, you know, for the other guys to get all their RBIs. They got the runs batted in, or you had to have somebody on base to get your runs batted in. I felt like I put a whole lot of runs batted in on the board for all these guys who are in the Hall of Fame. You got Eddie Murray, you got Winfield, you got Tome, you got Frank Thomas. I played with all those guys, Chipper Jones. I played with all those guys, and I was on the base for those guys to get those runs batted in. So, again, I just felt like now my time would be shown that, okay, we also need these type of guys in the game that will help the game move the way it's supposed to be moved, because speed, you know, and what I did is something that people don't do nowadays. That's the problem. They think about home runs. You know, it's either strikeout or you hit a home run. But I just want to, you know, if that happens, I'll be just thankful that somebody finally looked at my job as a leadoff hitter, center fielder, who did the job the right way.
And, Kenny, I got to tell you, as someone who covered a lot of games you played in the postseason, you drove opponents crazy. Like you and Omar Vizquel running around the bases and creating opportunity for your teammates. You drove, you and Carlos drove other teams crazy. It was a lot of fun to watch. And I appreciate the time you put in with us today.
No problem. Thank you.
Bleacher Tweets.
Okay, Buster, we got some Bleacher Tweets here for you. First one comes from Ernesto Cedillo at ErnieC3777. If the Yankees can't land a difference-making starter like Marcus Stroman or Trevor Bauer, does it make more sense for them to go for high-leverage bullpen guys to add to their strength? Given how early managers dip into the bullpen, it could be more valuable in October anyway.
Yeah, Ernesto, I do think the Yankees are going to add to their bullpen. If you look at the history of Brian Cashman's work, he likes the stealth strikes on the reliever market. And so, and I don't know who that's going to be, but, you know, Will Smith, the Tony Watson, that sort of guy, somebody identified by the Yankees analytics department. I think not only will they add to the rotation, but they'll get one of those type of guys.
Next tweet comes from Terry Hyena at Terry Hyena. With the second half starting, which team is in need to trade for a starting pitcher sooner rather than later?
Troy, you back me up on this. I think what we saw last night from the Astros and from Valdez, the Astros need a starting pitcher because their depth has taken a huge hit with a lot of the injuries they've had here in the first half.
Yeah, definitely. And if they don't want the Rangers to catch up with them in the division, they will certainly need to make some moves. Scott Mixon, next tweet comes from him. Who do y'all think the Braves will go out and target before the trade deadline?
And it's interesting because I think the Braves are a little bit like the Yankees with their staff. Their bullpen has actually performed really well. I think they're number one or number two in the National League in bullpen ERA, especially since that ugly start that they had. It could use some rotation help, and they could use some bullpen help. And I think it just comes down to you know, which becomes the better deal for them, the most efficient deal, the deal that, you know, Alex Anthopoulos thinks is better in terms of the cost. I can't tell you exactly what they're going to add, specifically type of pitcher, but I think they are going to add pitching before the trade deadline.
We talked about this a little bit yesterday, Buster, with some changes that the Atlantic League is tinkering with. So this tweet comes from John Paul Upton at Sky Blue Giant. Could another selling point of robo umpires be in-game consistent strike zones? In a number of games I watched, the zone seems to wander as the umpires fatigue, especially during the later innings. Both pitchers and hitters seem to get annoyed by this.
I would agree with that. Look, and I think it especially comes down on hitters. Troy, you'll back me up on this. A lot of games you watch, you know, let's say it's a slog early on, and then later in the game, when, you know, it's one-sided one way or the other, and the hitters are trying not to give away at bats, and all of a sudden the strike zone changes, and it gets bigger. Or, you know, John Paul, as you suggest, the umpires get tired, and the strike zone changes, and it's not right. I don't think it's right. If you're a hitter and you're training for those at-bats and you take a ball that's 3 inches off the plate, it should be a ball.
Yeah, it's a real thing. They do. The umpires do fatigue as the game gets on. I know they do want, as much as they want to do their job, they do want to leave too. So maybe they change the zone sometimes. Last tweet comes from Jeremy T. MSSATC at Jeremy Tiermini, who asks, "Hey, I was an upstate New York Rangers fan, like me, when Will Clark played there. His 1987 Topps card is one of my favorites. Troy and Buster, you go first, Buster. What is your favorite baseball card in your collection?"
You know, I got the first baseball cards that I collected were in the summer of 1973. I was 9 years old, and one of the first ones I got was a Lee May card, which on the back had a mistake on it. And, you know, here I am at 9 years old, not even thinking about the possibility that they're actually making mistakes on these baseball cards. And it had that Lee May, it had a cartoon figure of him swinging the bat. It said, "Lee hit blah, blah, blah in the World Series." And the number they put on his bat was .000. And I was trying to figure out, like, why is that a good thing? Why are they highlighting that? That Lee May hit zero in the World Series in 1970. And, of course, it was just simply a mistake. But I puzzled and puzzled that like the Grinch for weeks and weeks. Like, I don't understand. What's the point they're trying to make? What about you?
Right. I love that. So, I mean, baseball cards did not mean as much to my generation as they did to yours. Obviously, I'm only 23. But I was a big baseball cards guy when I was a kid. And my 2007 Cincinnati Reds Josh Hamilton, which is signed, I have that framed in my bedroom. And that's definitely my favorite baseball card.
But do you have an Alfonso Soriano autograph?
I do not. I do not. But maybe one day. Thanks for the Bleacher tweets today, folks. Hey, if you want to get on the show, you guys know that Buster loves his trade deadline talk. So if you want to get on the show, bring those questions. Use the hashtag Bleacher tweets.
And that's it for today. My thanks to Kenny Loft and to Chris Woodward and to Dave Schoenfield and Troy Farkas producing back in Bristol. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.